Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, standing in for Alex, and I'm joined by David. How are you, David?
I am well. A little bit tired, but otherwise okay. And surviving the fires.
Can we establish where you are in the world and that you're safe?
I am at my home in Hollywood, California, where it's actually quite cold and rainy today. At least as cold and rainy as LA gets, but given the week we've had, that's a good thing.
And it's somewhat ironic that the film we're going to talk about this week is Blade Runner, set in Los Angeles in 2019.
Yeah, and looking a lot like it has this past week, actually.
It's going to get pretty funky in LA in the next 12 years, by all reckoning.
Yeah, which is, when you look around how it is now, that's a scary thought. But you look at Blade Runner and you see, you can't see the night sky and you see flames shooting up in the air. And, well, that's pretty much what we got right now.
So let's discuss the film. It's about to be re-released for about the 700th time. And this version of the film is hopefully, or, you know, touted to be the final cut by Ridley Scott. It's obviously a very influential film. When did you first come across it?
I can't remember, like, the first time I saw it. I know for a lot of people it was, like, the film that introduced them to the world of sci-fi movies, but I came across it after I came across Star Trek and Star Wars, so those were a lot more influential on me. But I remember, I think I was maybe 15 or 16 when I really sat down and gave it a fair shot. Other than just, you know, I made an effort to watch it. So that was like 15 years ago. So I can't even remember what version it was, whether it had the voiceover or not.
Yeah. Well, the film, of course, came out in about 82 and suffered tremendously from coming out at the same time that E.T. did, which meant that it actually really wasn't that much of a hit when it first came out. But it obviously has moved into sort of legendary cult status. And, of course, the other thing is that Ridley's gone on to do some amazing work, as have many of the other cast members, though some of the actors haven't fared so well, but we'll get to that in a second. have you seen the previous release to this, which was the somewhat rushed director's cut from about 92?
I just saw that about maybe a year ago. It was playing in high def on HDNet, and so it was a very nice transfer. You know, and I believe that was the version I saw. It was just director's cut.
So the new version is not dramatically different from that, though slightly different. And there have been a bunch of things that have been done. Some of them, interestingly, just visual effects stuff, like removing wires that Ridley saw and just annoyed the hell out of him. And But I think it's kind of ironic because we're going back in 82 to an age before digital, and some of the decisions in the film reflected what they couldn't do because of visual effects back then. And I think actually worked rather well, not least of which is to hide wires, they decided to make it raining a lot. And I like that it's raining a lot. I like that it's so wet and gritty and you know, very un-LA.
It's very un-LA, and it's... You know, I for all the issues I may have with the movie as a movie, visually I think it's absolutely stunning, and I think it's the sci-fi version of Jaws, where, you know, they didn't have like if you made Jaws today, I'm sure you'd see, you know, 1800 CG shots of the shark during the movie. But I think it's Blade Runner did the same thing, where they weren't able to do whatever the director wanted. So he worked around it, and it turns out being, it forces you to make artistic decisions, which you wouldn't have come to originally, and it makes it a better film.
Yeah, it really is the case that that it's a film that that benefited, as you say, from the limitations rather than being a film that was defined by them. And I think that... I think both that and the stuff that Sid Mead did in terms of design were just outstanding. I mean, we were lucky enough to interview Sid Mead for FX Guide TV when we were at SIDGRAPH. He was down there with the guys from Soft Image. And, man, he was just an extraordinary guy to talk to. But hearing him talk about Blade Runner and how he got onto it was quite extraordinary. I don't know if you know the story of how he got involved with Ridley.
I do not.
He basically was brought in because they were he was pretty much at that stage a futurist, and in fact that was the end credit that he got for the film. Futurist, but he was brought in, and very early on they sort of weren't really quite sure how to solve a bunch of the design problems. He was brought in, and luckily he and Ridley both speak in kind of well, drawings really. If you don't know if you've ever been on set or know anyone that's been on set with Ridley, but he's renowned for basically doing these little sketches and drawings and stuff and these squiggles, and it was basically a visual communication that happened between the two of them. And so much of the design stuff that I think is so cool, you know, was that Sid Mead kind of futurist vision.
Yeah, I think the really interesting thing about Blade Runner is that if you come to the movie today, if you're seeing the movie for the first time today, you're going to look at it and go and think that it just looks so stereotypical and just like every other sci-fi movie you've ever seen. But you have to put it into your head that that's because everyone else ripped off this movie. And that, like, what Sid Mead did is he defined how that kind of, you know, dark and dirty near future sci-fi look was going to look for everybody. You look at, you know, The Matrix, and you look at, I mean, you can make a list of movies that have come in the past 15 years that have been inspired visually by this movie, and it would be every sci-fi movie. I could ask you to name 15 movies, sci-fi movies off the top of your head, and then make a list of 15 movies that were visually inspired by Blade Runner, and they'd probably be the exact same list.
Yeah. The movie, I mean, really was so influential in so many other. Of course, the other person we really need to credit is Douglas Trumbull for his work as the visual effects supervisor on it. And his credits around the time of Blade Runner are just astounding, because he was basically special effects photography on 2001, so that's the late 60s. Then there's Close Encounters in 77, Star Trek The Motion Picture in 79, and Blade Runner in 82, all of which earned him Academy Award nominations. So, you know, the realization of those design aspects that we've talked about, I mean, just a huge amount of credit must go to him.
Yeah, I have actually had the pleasure of meeting him a couple of times. And just an amazingly gregarious man. So it's one of those people that you meet and you kind of do the hamana, you know, they're the work that they've done has so influenced what you have, you know, meeting Dennis Muren or Phil Tippett, you know, it's the legends that, you know, and they're and the good thing about all of them is they're the first ones to credit all the people who are around them as well.
Oh yeah,
they know. But I love the fact that so much of that movie was done as in-camera stuff.
Totally.
You know, not as a complicated post-processing of opticals and everything like that. It's just, we're going to build these big models. We're going to build television screens into those models, and then we're going to fill the room with smoke and send a camera through it.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking to Sid Mead, he was pointing out that the cop car that they're, you know, flying around in was really built and was really on wires and really lifted off the ground and spun around. And it did give it a very sort of physical or physicality that just really translates onto the screen, I think.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that, you know, it's very rare, very, very rare that you'll look at a movie that's 25 years old and the visual effects hold up.
Yeah, I think that one of the great things is that it also avoided the problem of doing the impossible. Like, there was, you know, obviously chase sequences and some fairly elaborate, you know, building jumps and things like this, but still it wasn't in the zone that you completely didn't believe that someone was capable of doing it. You never sort of thought, well, Harrison Ford's indestructible, Deckery's character is never going to die, it's all going to be good. It was gritty, and you know, it felt dirty, and it felt like when they were being punched, they were being punched.
Yeah. I think it was in that that golden era of action films, you know, where they were still grounded in, I can't believe I'm saying this about Blade Runner, still grounded in reality, you know, and then we transitioned into the whole Die Hard phase, and you know, now we're getting back into the reality of it. But the you know, the some of the stuff that the technology that they're doing with the replicants and all that kind of stuff, it became, you bought it easier. Like those story points that were so ridiculous, you bought it easier because the world seemed so complete and so real. If that makes sense, you know.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It was also I thought one of the cool things about the movie design wise was that it had a very unique and complete vision, but it wasn't as if the entire world, even though it was really designed by, you know, pretty much one person, but it didn't feel like the entire place was designed by one person. You know, that there are different styles of architecture and there's different styles of signage and costumes and everything like that. It just made it feel much more like an urban center would.
I remember at the time being surprised at the whole Chinese thing in the Chinese culture at street level and stuff. I remember distinctly at the time thinking, I wonder why they jumped that way, because it was, you know, kind of alluding to a globalization that we've now take for granted. But some of those ideas must have seemed pretty far-fetched at the planning stage. Not necessarily having Chinese characters in the film, but, you know, that whole idea of mixing up the cultures to the extent that it did. And that, you know, absolutely iconic shot of the vast billboard with the rain and the city behind, which has got to be one of the greatest sci-fi shots ever.
Yeah. I mean, the movies is full of those. You have that. You have the spinner flying up to the pyramid and, you know, the columns of fire. And, yeah, it's there. Like, the more we talk about the movie, there's more it sounds like I don't have problems with the movie. But, you know, the... there's so much about the movie that was so ahead of its time. And I think that's why it maybe failed originally at the box office and then gained a following as it got released. And I also think it's one of those movies that really benefited from home video, because it's one of those movies that you may not understand the first time you watch it.
There are films for me, like, I'm going to get shot for saying this, right? There are films for me like Tron that I tend to remember as being better than they actually were. If you made me sit down and watch Tron again now, I'm sure I would find vast swathes of it to be completely boring. I mean, it had great design and all, but you remember the great design years on, and the story actually wasn't that good, right? I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
I think initially the story on Blade Runner did have problems. I think it was confusing, and then the voiceover made it kind of weird. And also, I don't know that the whole sort of tech-noir thing that was going down, I was almost, as you say, ready for back then. But yeah, when you watch it now on DVD with really, you know, with the benefit of time, I think the story has improved from the re-editing.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the interesting things about the re-editing, and, you know, when you were talking about remembrances of the film, it's weird the fact that you can remember the movie and then you'll go and watch it again if it's on cable or you rent it, and you'll be like, this isn't what I remembered. And you're not, with this movie, it may be that you are actually remembering correctly. It's just you're watching a different version. You know? You know, and I'm gonna be interested. I'm gonna go. I think it's gonna be playing at the ArcLight here in LA. I want to go and see it. And of course, there's the that HD DVD version that's coming out in December that has like 8 different versions of the movie. So,
yeah, well, I know it's going to be shown here in Sydney in mid-November, digitally projected 4K, which will be pretty extraordinary to see. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I hear the restoration is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's another thing. Like the superb job done by the digital restoration team. I mean, we've spoken a lot about visual effects in various VFX shows, but the restoration guys, oh my God, it's remarkable. I mean, go back to Star Wars, for example. I remember seeing some split screens of where the film was at before they restored it and just how washed out it was and how pathetically low contrast it had become versus what they're getting out of rescanning this, because this was rescanned at 4K, right?
I believe it is, and then hand retouched frame by frame.
So it's just an amazing amount of work to get to keep that kind of original quality. And, you know, I mean, some things age, right? Personally, I've never been a big Vangelis fan. I mean, the soundtrack for me, the whole sort of futuristic synthesizer thing, kind of not where I'm at, right? Like, it's Chariots of Fire on acid, and I just don't particularly buy into it. But when it comes to the visuals, oh, my God, I think they're magnificent.
I actually find that the two things that never hold up in film ever are music and hairstyles. Like, costumes will often hold up, but hairstyles never do. And music never does either. But it's amazing that you look at so much of what the, like, you could make that movie today, and have that exact same vision of the future, and it would still, you wouldn't have to really change anything about it, you know? And, I mean, everything from, like, Serenity and Firefly kind of takes that whole Chinese-American blending, those ideas, and the whole world idea of the whole off-world idea. Actually, now that I'm saying that, it does sound like they did take a lot from Blade.
Well, yeah, I think they did. And I think that, you know, it's not, it's certainly not, you know, unnoted how referenced it's been, and everything from you know, movies that are both derivative and just blatant ripoffs, right through to, you know, sound music kind of, you know, that, I don't know, that just sort of like whole feeling of the future no longer being shiny and happy and being actually pretty miserable. I mean, Alien did it a fair bit anyway. You know, this idea that the world in the future wouldn't be sort of sparkly and shiny, and we wouldn't all be, you know, whereas you had the sinister stuff like in THX, which was, you know, white and sinister, but it was still very clean. A lot of those future visions were like that. If they were positive, everyone was perky. If they weren't, they were still, I don't know, Logan's Run kind of, you know, nice and jumpsuity, very sort of velour Star Trek-y.
Yeah.
But Blade Runner was just so much like, you know, you're in for a bad time here.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a movie of the era. You know, you could make that same movie, I think, again today. But you probably wouldn't have made that same movie in the mid-90s. But, you know, it's a very, in a lot of ways, very pessimistic movie on almost every level. And, you know, I'm not sure how it ends now, with all the edits. But because I know there's a disagreement between Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott as to whether or not Decker is a replicant, so
I'm not going to spoil it, but I think they've actually come together on that. I think in this version there's actually been a fairly much widely documented kind of meeting, you know, that they did obviously have a big falling out, and for a while they were happily criticizing each other to death, but I think now there is actually, you know, 25 years on, quite a good deal of healthy bridge building that's gone on.
Right, but my wondering is whether or not they're going to still leave it ambiguous in this final edit of the film.
Yeah, well, I don't think we should discuss the final ending, because if someone hasn't seen the new version, that's about one of the few things that's up for grabs, right? The whole the whole origami kind of theme stuff that certainly with the I personally like where they've gone with it, and I'm comfortable with it, and I think that it's the only position that makes sense. But you should really see the film, because it's about, as I say, it's like, we can't really spoil the plot because obviously it's pretty well known, but that's one of the few aspects that's left.
Hey, so you've seen this new edit, correct?
I've seen this new edit, but I've seen it in a preview.
Okay, so my quick question is, the stuff that they reshot just recently, how well does that blend in to the rest of the film visually?
I Look, I think that they've done an incredibly good job in putting it together. I think the film sits really well, and I don't think that. Well, let's see. Are you going to the film looking for stuff, or are you going to the film to watch it? I think if you're going to the film to watch it, you'll be quite happy with it, right? I think if you're going to the film to kind of analyze it, then you're going to get into a couple of places that are problematical, because there have been some shots that have been extended. There's been some extensive work done on shots that no longer are quite as gritty and as they were. So I guess my attitude is that it's dangerous for us to go and see a film like this when there's so much history on it, because you're almost sitting there trying to count the differences and spot the variations and work out if you can work out what they've done to the shots, right down to, you know, whether or not that the scene behind the dove is, you know, real projected or digital or flat screen or, you know, whatever it is. And I think actually overall I would say there's been a remarkable job in terms of restoration, tying it together and having it look consistent throughout. I think it's I think people are gonna be really surprised at how fresh it looks, given that it, as you say, has certain aspects in it make it clearly dated. I mean, as you say, some of the haircuts and stuff, no matter how period they are. Having said that, Daryl Hannah still looks pretty mean when she does that spray airbrushing across her face.
Was that her first movie role?
I don't know. It's certainly my favorite role of hers. She was, that was a good look. I thought she... I don't think she ever got back to that. Well, the other one was Sean Young, right? Like, who didn't really... I mean, she did a few things after that, and she's been in quite a few things, I guess, in one way or another, but...
All I remember about her is the whole thing with Catwoman.
Yes, her applying for it?
Yes, dressing up in the costume. And
yeah, not a good look, was it?
No. And with Daryl Hannah, I'd have to go with the whole Ellie Driver look from Kill Bill.
Yeah, I don't know. I just... I think, I don't know. I'll tell you one person, Edward James Olmos, who's just, I'll see anything that guy's in any time of the day or night. He's obviously in this, but of course he's been in, you know, Battlestar Galactica most recently. And everything from that to the, what was the role he played as a school teacher in East LA? Stand and Deliver, I think it was.
I believe that was that one.
Yeah.
There's been many of those.
But anything he's in, I just think he's terrific as an actor.
He's utterly fantastic as an actor. And the it's weird. It's when you go down the cast that was in this. You know, Rutger Hauer and Harrison Ford and everything. You know, imagine trying to assemble the same cast today. You know, it's regardless of whether or not some people's careers have been more successful than others, but. The fact is, it's like it wasn't a one-hit wonder for really anyone in that movie.
No, and I tell you, the other one that really it launched the career of was Philip Dick himself, because his short stories are now so common as film fodder. But this was really the first major film of any of his short stories, and now, you know, we've had so many from what was the one that Tom Cruise was in?
Minority Report,
right through. Yeah, there's been like just, you know, almost anything he's ever written now, I think, has been put to film.
Yeah, some of them twice.
Yeah, but this was the one that really launched it.
Right. Believe it or not, there actually is a sequel to the movie.
To Blade Runner?
There is a sequel to Blade Runner.
Really?
It's not official, but the same guy who did the screen adaptation of Blade Runner, he wrote a movie called Soldier with Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
He has said it's supposed to take place in the Blade Runner universe, on one of the off-worlds. And there's actually a spinner in the movie.
Huh.
It's just one of those weird things where he wanted to write a sequel, I think he actually, he said it's not really a sequel, but it's another story in the same universe, whatever that would be called.
And so what was the name of the film? Soldier, did you say?
Soldier, yeah. It came out like 97, 98.
Huh.
It was Kurt Russell and the guy who played Bruce Lee in that movie Dragon.
I'm not really a Kurt Russell fan, so that would have stopped me seeing that film right out of the bait. even Tarantino with Kurt Russell won't get me into a cinema.
What about John Carpenter's The Thing?
Yeah, not going there.
Really? You're missing out, my friend.
Yeah, sorry. Just bugs the living daylights out of me, that guy. What can I say?
I can understand that. There's a couple of actors who just completely will turn me off.
Well, more than anything else, and I guess to a certain extent this was the case with a criticism that was leveled at Indiana Jones for Harrison Ford, right, which was the same character that he played in Star Wars, just in a different era, right? But for me, it's always just Kurt Russell. It's never anyone else but Kurt Russell when he's in a film, right? So, you know, I mean, like it's that, you know, you get some actors who are in the role and you completely understand and appreciate the role and the character. And anything that Meryl Streep's in, right, she is that character for that film. Yeah. But, you know, there are other actors that no matter, Schwarzenegger comes to mind, right? It just is Schwarzenegger. It doesn't matter what they name the character in the film, it's the same guy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he ever really tried to push himself. I mean, other than he made forays into comedy, but at least he never tried to do hard drama.
Okay.
You know, he wasn't. Can you imagine if he had tried to do the thing that, like Robin Williams, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dead Poets Society? That just wouldn't have worked.
Well, now getting back to Blade Runner, more human than human is our motto. Is there anything that we haven't touched on? I guess the only thing for me, the cinematography hardly ever gets a mention, and I actually thought it was really good cinematography. It was really good camera work.
And I think it was also the it was one of the first movies, especially for you know, a very effects-y sci-fi type movie, that said, you know, we're going to turn the lights off. The look of the movie is defined a lot by how little you actually see. You know, everything's dark. Everything is, when there is light, it's filled with smoke or whatever. You know, there's the scene where Harrison Ford first goes to the office to give the test. You know, it's a very, you know, what's dark is dark and what's light is light and very bright and blown out. And it's a very beautiful film, and I think that one of the things that if people are listening to this that have only grown up post Jurassic Park, you know, you can look back, not the re-edit where they've gone in and digitally cleaned it up, but there's no digital effects in this movie whatsoever. You know, this is you know, old school. Just we're going to do matte paintings. We're going to do translights. We're going to do as much of it in camera as we can. And I think, you know, we get lost nowadays in just doing everything in the computer without doing it in the most basic way possible, which is just to do it and get it in camera.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. And it really gets back to your initial point that you started with, which is that this is the sci-fi version of Jaws, right? Yeah, it's dark. It leaves a lot to the imagination. The kind of ominous. There's always a kind of foreboding or even a threatening kind of something going on through Blade Runner. You know, bad things are going to happen, kind of thing. Which I really think comes, as you say, from the darks, from turning the lights off.
Yeah, it really does. You don't, for a single moment in the entire movie, feel like anything good is going to happen to any of these characters. You know, you want something good to happen to them, but you really honestly think everything's going to turn out really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, the other person we should mention, along with Douglas Trumbull, is Richard Urich, who was the, you know, worked with Trumbull on this and, of course, went on to do Mission Impossible 2 and you know, tons of stuff like that. And I'm just trying to think, though. I don't actually know. Where were the visual effects? Did they form their own company to do this, or?
I do not know.
I think they did, actually. Is that?
Yeah. It's and
God, I should know that.
Yeah, you're actually going to see that more and more. I think you're going to see a lot more. Again, going back to, you'll have the funneling work given off to, you know, given off to your ILEMs, your Wetas, your Rhythm and Hues of the world. But I think you're going to see a lot more, like internalizing, you know, not to the extent of, you know, doing what Lucas did where he sets up his own facility. But, you know, for films, they set up these art departments that used to just do a lot of concept art. But now they're setting them up and you're doing a year's worth of previs on a movie. And that's, you know, those same people are moving on to continue with the post work as well. And I think you're going to see a lot more of these, you know, that we're moving into an era of boutiques again. You know, we kind of go through these waves in our industry where you have these mammoth facilities of, you know, 1,000 people that take on 1,800 shot shows. And then you'll have, you know, 15 little boutiques who all take on 150 shots or 300 shots or whatever. But if you're going to see a lot more productions, I think, kind of forming their own little mini boutiques of like 40, 50 people that are kind of going to have a lot of their hands in the visual effects, you know, because you're seeing a lot more that you'll have an animation supervisor and a visual effects supervisor who's attached to the production, not to a company, you know.
Yeah.
Where you'll have a visual effects supervisor on the film, and then you'll also have a visual effects supervisor at the facility that's doing the effects.
Yep.
You know, and it's the VFX supervisor on the film has the ear of the director. The VFX supervisor at the facility has the ear of the VFX supervisor on the film. So I think you're going to see a lot more of these like building up facilities that then dissipate into the ether after a movie's done.
Hmm. Yeah, and no, I think that's the case. And while we're on credits, I guess we should give some credit to the guys that worked on this newest version, the final cut, because I believe The Orphanage did some stuff, and also Lola did some stuff next to Hydraulics there in Los Angeles, and they've obviously done a really good job, as did the guys that were doing all the restoration work. I'm not quite sure who did all the restoration work, but...
I think the restoration work was done by the same guys who did the cleanups of Indiana Jones and Star Wars.
Right. Well, they've done a terrific job.
I forget the name of the company, which I really should remember, because... I sat next to three of the artists who did all that work at Comic-Con a couple of years ago. they were behind me in line for one of the panels. We wound up sitting together. Very nice guys. And I mean, those are the guys, you know, they do the same work on every VFX show today. You know, you'll get plates in, at least when plates are shot in film, and they have to go in and clean up all those scratches and all that dust and everything like that. And that's off of a brand new print.
Mm.
But, I think you know, you think about how film is handled, you know, we have to take this magazine of film that's, you know, this light sensitive material and stick it into a bag that you can't see. And as you open it up, you know, you're going to get scratches. You're handling, you know, a very sensitive, material that you have in a bag with metal parts that are rattling around. You're going to get scratches on it. And these are the guys that at every VFX facility today get no respect. You know, everyone always talks about the animation or whatever, but if you don't have a match mover, if you don't have someone who's cleaning up your plates, you know, those kind of down in the dirty grunt work, those are the guys that really make all these films look good today, and you know, are making older films look fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, wire and rig removal and roto artists are just unsung heroes. I've said that before.
Yeah, you'll hear about, you know, 1,800 shots on a movie, and then you'll look at it and go, I can maybe pick out 600. You know, so you know those other 1,200 were, you know, painting out a boom mic, or you know.
And some of those shadows are really hard and things to get rid of, like reflections in windows, shadows. You know, it's not easy. It's not like just, well, we get the comp and we'll composite it and really fuss with the key. It's like, oh, my God, I have to reconstruct this from a few frames that I can snatch here and there and then build it back together again. It's actually quite detailed work.
And it's mind-blowingly or mind-numbingly, you know, tedious at points. You know, it's actually interesting with this movie, the way, you know, it's where it's so black and it's so white, whether the same look would have been attempted today shooting digital.
Right? Yeah, that's a good question, actually.
Where, you know, you don't have that, you know, flexibility or, you know, the dynamic range of film is such that, you know, I can't imagine a DP, you know, grabbing a red and trying to attempt this look without a lot of experimentation and, you know, just like, screw it, we'll do it in DI, you know?
Yeah, though having said that, like, I think that with things like red, like once you get, because obviously any cinematographer who's got a major feature has got a lot of experience with film. I think that once you've got a lot of experience with digital, then, you know, shooting a low light, dark film is exactly what you'd want to do. I mean, I think that would be, do you know, I mean, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but I agree that they would go for DI, but still, you know, I think some of the new stuff is just that it's new, you know what I mean? Like, it'll all be taken for granted in a year or three.
Maybe more. I know a lot of cinematographers who are still very resistant to working with digital.
Now, David, just from finishing up, what are you on at the moment? What are you up to?
I am going to be on Avatar for the foreseeable future. Right now, I'm one of maybe 15 people holding down the fort here in Los Angeles while they're off filming principal live action in New Zealand, which is nice because my life is a little bit calmer and I'm actually working on a short film right now. And about to be suffering through a major writer's strike, which will be interesting to see how all that goes down.
You think it's going to happen?
I firmly believe it's going to happen. I have a lot of friends who are in the WGA, and they're all convinced it's going to that there's definitely going to be a strike. The only question is how long. And it's you know, we're getting down to the wire, quite literally. A couple days from now is when the 2 days from now is when the collective bargaining agreement expires. And we'll see what happens. You know, I don't think they're going to walk out right away. But the interesting thing isn't only the writer's strike itself, but how that spreads out through the industry. Because first of all, you have other unions who will not cross picket lines. So, like the Teamsters just said today that they will not cross a picket line, which means that UPS can't get delivered. Your drinking water can't get delivered. All those kind of things, you know, that, you know, so you have that immediate effect, but you're really going to see it in 8 months, 9 months. You know, we're visual effects people are usually a little bit more insulated because post work happens so much farther down the line. So I could see it having one of two effects on us, which is either producers going, well, we don't have a lot of product coming down the pipeline, so we're going to push the release date of this movie 2 months later, and now you have two extra months to work on stuff. And maybe the schedules will get a little bit more sane. You could also run into the issue where, oh my God, we're out of content. And let's take this stupid script that we've had sitting on the shelf for a year and a half or whatever off the shelf and say, wow, we can make this. And, you know, regardless of how good it is or what have you. So I think in the post-production field, if the strike does happen and is of any kind of length, we'll start to feel it in about a year. Obviously, everyone else will feel it immediately around here. If the writer's strike happens and it goes more than I would say 3 weeks, it's just going to devastate the economy here in Southern California because everything will come to a halt. Because if, you know, if writers aren't working, then makeup artists and costume people and grips and, you know, PAs aren't working. If they're not working, then they're not going out to dinner. They're not going out to dinner. You know, restaurants don't need as many waiters and waitresses, you know, and then they're not getting money and they're not spending money at the mall at Christmas. So, you know, it could be really devastating. And the interesting thing is we'll probably wrap this all up in time, right in time for the SAG strike next summer. Because SAG and the Directors Guild, both of their contracts are expiring in the second quarter of next year. And they are probably going to go on strike for the exact same reason the writers are going to go on strike. And it all comes down to this wonderful thing we're doing right now, which is media on the internet.
Yep, absolutely. Well, look, I have to go. I'm making, obviously, stuff for FX PhD, where you can find me at either FX PhD or FX Guide. And unfortunately, I'm out of time. I'd love to just talk to you about the moral and ethical implications of the strike. Maybe we'll do that next time. But thank you so much for joining us, David. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be a part of the show. I missed out last week when you guys were talking about the Red and the Kingdom, because a friend of mine was the DP on the Kingdom. Yeah.
Well, so. As you no doubt heard, we thought it was an excellent film.
Oh, it was unbelievably good. And if you like Peter Berg, he's the guy who directed that movie, rent a great action movie called The Rundown with The Rock. It's one of those ones where you check your brain at the door, grab some popcorn. It's a slam bang, funny, action-packed, awesome movie.
Cool. Well, I'll do that. Until we talk to you next time, we're out of time. I'm Mike Seymour. Thank you, David, again.
I'm David Trepenis.
And we'll talk to you next week when hopefully Alex will be back. Talk to you then. Bye.
All right. Later.